From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Roth Feeder Pig Incorporated is gearing up for a major expansion now that the State Department of Natural Resources has approved the project. The new Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, or CAFO, will be the second for owner A.V. Roth. The new facility is expected to produce nearly 150,000 piglets a year, and you can find more information on that in a wonderful story that our colleague Danielle Kading did that's on WPR.org. And joining us now to talk about his family's operation, including the new expansion, is A.V. Roth. Welcome to Newsmakers, A.V.
Hello. Thank you for your time.
Well, I'm interested in the new project, and we'll get into that. But just talk about your family's farm in Crawford County has been around for multiple generations. Talk about the history of it and how you got involved in it.
I'm a fifth generation farmer. I've been around hogs my entire life. You know, my grandparents and great grandparents grew up here. They had dairy. There always was some pigs on the farm, so I went through that. My folks know the history a heck of a lot better than I do. The homestead is actually on the back side of this farm. It's a century farm. So it's always interesting. I didn't really enjoy doing dairy. I much preferred working with pigs, and that's why I went in that direction.
And you've been the owner of the farm now for how long?
So I took over the pig side of the farm and acreage that it was on in 98.
Okay, so going on 25 years anyway, when people think about a pig farm, I don't know who has what perception of what that means, but your operation is quite a large one, and the expansion is going to be quite large again. How many animals will you have on that farm at any one time, and then how many will you be able to deal with through the course of a year?
So on the farm here, we have about, we're just short of 3,000 sows, about 2,900. So we sell wean pigs. They are about 21 days old, about 15 pounds, and we do about 73,000 to 75,000 pigs a year. At any given time, we have about 3,000 little pigs on the farm here. The expansion is going to be about 5,000 sows, and looking at putting out, you know, hopefully right around 150,000 pigs, little pigs a year. They're going to be 21 days old and 15 pounds. Again, going to do the best that I can to put out as many as I can. That's part of the game. It's part of being sustainable here. If I was only putting out 10 pigs out of this farm a year, I wouldn't be here very long, and somebody else would own it, and somebody else would be doing what they want to with the land.
In terms of doing what you want to with the land, you've had to jump through some hoops to get approval for what you. I mean, you can't just set up an operation like that and hit go. Talk about what you have already in place and what you have to have in place in order for this expansion to open in terms of protecting the environment, making sure that you're not having a negative impact on the land and water around you.
About 5 years ago, I was starting to see that I was going to need to expand at some point. So I brought my uncle's farm. He is up there just north or just south of Steuben, and started asking some farmers around there, you know, would you be interested in getting some manure? And just, you know, checking that out to see what the possibility was. Once I found out there was many farmers over there that would love to get the manure, and trust me, this year they would have really appreciated if they could have got some out of there. It would have saved quite a bit of money for their operations. Going over it with them, coming up with the people that will be buying the pigs, you know, talking, they have the need, they want to expand. And so that's where the idea started. And then going through the steps, first thing I had to do is just get these people, you know, take the acres. They had to come in, get soil tested, had to go through all the nutrient management plan so that could be put into the DNR. And same thing goes with the engineering plans, the runoff plans, everything you can think of that the DNR is going to look at had to be put into them. So that was submitted over 2 years ago. And same thing with me, I've given, you know, the DNR has to stand by their permit, so I give them plenty of time. I, you know, talk to them if they want anything else, here's what we can do. They went through, they came back to me in October and they asked me for if they could do four more things. One of them was the geology department wanted to I forget what they were called, want to look at the wells when we dig our wells. I want to send equipment down them and look them. Yep, we can do that. Another thing they asked me to do is to make sure it was cased to 300 feet, at least 300 feet. That's, you know, my uncle put in a well there in the last 15 years, and he cased it 300 feet. And I told him, you know, I talked to the drillers and talked to them. Yeah, absolutely. That was what they were going to suggest, is 300 feet. Absolutely. And actually just going to the SWG study and listening to them, it's a really good thing. The newer the well, the better it is about being protected from contamination.
Now, what's a SWG study for the uninitiated?
So the SWG study was they checked 830 wells twice over a year's time, and they came up with what was going on in those things and how groundwater and things looked down there in those counties.
In your particular case, in other kinds of agricultural operations, you have concerns with all kinds of runoff and different things. In the case of a pig farm, it's pretty much what happens with all the manure is the main concern, right?
That's absolutely. That's what I've listened to the people, and that is their concern. So the first thing that the engineering, the pits that the manure would be stored in before it's applied to the fields are engineered just like they would be at any wastewater facility. You have to jump through those hoops. The amount of rebar that will be in this storage vessel is unbelievable. You literally cannot step without stepping on rebar to make sure it's as strong as it can be. And I always make sure I have plenty of storage in case something happens. So then you look at, you know, going through your nutrient plan, it actually, what you got to do is you're putting on nutrients the same as if you were putting on commercial fertilizer. So I don't put on more nitrogen that the plants are going to use, because why would I want to do that and waste my money? Especially if you're like this and how much nitrogen is. The farmers around here, they would, again, like I said, would love to have that nutrient this year. And you go through that, and there's things that say on this slope or on this soil, you only put this many gallons on to start with. In the fall, you can come back on the spring and you put in more. Some fields you won't be able to put on to the needs of the nitrogen. You have to put on to phosphorus needs, and so on and so forth. But when I went through the actual nutrient management or nutrient plans when we soil tested, there's a lot of soils up there that were extremely low in phosphorus. I think this, I know this will very benefit the soil fertility in the area up there. So that's some of the stuff that I was going through with the DNR. And so that all got put into, had a public meeting June 10th of last year. And they've been going over that study. You know, they asked me to do a few things and I did them, more than happy to. And moving forward, they gave me a permit. And my next steps is to now get the livestock siting permit.
So now the other aspect of environmental pollution is more a quality of life question for your neighbors. A lot of people might think that it just might smell bad being that close to that many pigs. Is there anything you can do about that, or are they just out of luck, or is that part of living in the country?
No, so Cropper Stewardship got the EPA to come out here and do an odor study. Came out here and had monitoring done on this farm. And I've brought this up many times, is that the monitoring went very well because they don't talk about it. Now, out in the country, pigs do smell. Don't ever get me wrong. At times, especially during spreading, you're going to smell it. Again, if I lived in a city, the same thing. There's times where you smell stuff that you don't want to. I'm going to do everything I can. We're going to inject manure. We're going to put up what they call plant trees around the fans. One of the biggest things in the summer is the dust blows out of these, and collecting that at the end is extreme. The other thing we're going to do is this will be washed. We're going to wash it at least twice a year, same as we do here. And that keeps the dust down. It really, you ask the people around here, yes, sometimes it does smell, but it's not very often. There is one person that, you know, that was a big worry about this thing when it became a CAFO. And they were so worried about it and smell it. The following year, they're like, well, what did you do? I never smell it now. And I didn't do anything different. It's part of farming. And if that smell wasn't there, then the pigs wouldn't be there. And that's not good for me. and not good for the people that work here. You know, the people I work here, I always tell them this isn't the best job, but it's definitely not the worst job. And if people can, you know, find something better, I'm more than happy to help them on their way. You know, but I treat everyone here like their family, and just like the new facility will.
To address, you talked about some of the things that you had to do in advance of the new operation opening, and even some of the things that you've done with the operation that you have that already exists. What happens as time goes on to make sure that your precautions are having the intended effect, that it is not affecting local water, that that pollution is not getting into, you know, the Kickapoo watershed or into the groundwater, things like that?
So some of the things that we, you know, still working on that, every time I go to spread, I got to print off a paper that says that it's not going to have a half inch of rain in the next 24 hours or 3/10 of an inch of rain the next 24 hours. I got to make sure that's printed off. And that's honestly, it's a good thing just to do. You know, if you spread that liquid manure out there, even if it is injected, you don't want it to run off. So those are the things that, you know, you really work on doing. And if there is something that happens, it needs to be reported right away, which I would do and would clean it up. One of the things that in that SWIC study that I found very interesting in Grant County is Grant County in the 80s was the 10th largest county for pork production in the country. And when they went and tested the wells, there was a couple that had some pig manure in it, but not very much. And for being that big of a county, across, you know, you look at Iowa now and it was bigger. I thought that was very good. I think the producers and farmers around here do a great job going out there, applying manure, applying fertilizer. Things have came a long ways in the last 50 years. You know, I talked to my dad and he said with phosphorus that when you'd go and buy phosphorus to put on your fields that the things, oh, it's just like a bank account. You know, you can pay for it this year, maybe next year you can't afford it. And you know now that those things aren't the right way. You know, you want to have enough phosphorus on there, but you definitely don't want to have too much. The fields will be, every 4 years, they'll get soil sampled. The manure, I have to sample every 2 months to make sure that the nutrients that are in there is what's in there, so I don't overapply that way. And going through there and just doing everything I can. For my well, I go through and make sure that I check my well once a year and any wells that I have around me.
You talk about sustainability of your business, needing to grow in order to, you know, have the business going the direction it needs to in order to support your family, everything like that. There's also sustainability in terms of protecting the environment, in terms of protecting the quality of life that people have come to expect living in the country and around farms. And talk about that balancing act and the idea of providing financially for your family versus, well, maybe not versus, but along with making sure that the farm, the land, the opportunity that's been there for your family all these years is there for your kids.
So that's the first thing. To me, sustainability is being able to pass that farm on to the next generation. And what does that mean? You have to take care of the land. You have to take care of the water. You have to take care of the community, and you have to take care of the bottom line.
When do you expect the you said you have another round of applications with not with the DNR, but with another organization. When do you expect that you might be operational on this new phase of your pig operation?
Again, with livestock siting, I put my permit in last Friday. There's 5 parts in livestock siting you put in. 3 of them, what you do is say that you have the WPDS permit from the DNR, and then they don't have to go through and look at it. Mostly the nutrient management, the runoff and all that. What you got to look at is just go back through the numbers and go through the odor score. That they have 45 days to consider it complete. And then they have another 90 days in livestock siting to deny or accept. I would like to be digging later this fall. It just depends on the fall goes and when I get this permit or not.
A.V. Roth is with the Roth Feeder Pig in Crawford County. A.V., thanks a lot for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Hey, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
We've been talking to A.V. Roth from Roth Feeder Pig. Of course, we always want to hear from you, too. You can email us anytime throughout the week. Our email address is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Coming up next, the other side of this conversation, we'll hear from the Crawford Stewardship Project, next on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall from our Southwest Wisconsin Bureau in La Crosse. As we've talked about earlier on the show, a new large-scale hog farm is almost a go in Crawford County. The Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, or CAFO, would be the second for Roth Feeder Pig Incorporated. The Crawford Stewardship Project has voiced objections to the new farm since applications were originally made. And joining us to talk about those objections and what is now what happens now is Forrest Yonke of the Crawford Stewardship Project. Forrest, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ezra.
Certainly. So we talked earlier in the show to A.V. Roth, who's the farmer in question here. He told us about his new operation, so the listeners are up to speed on that. What's your big concern about the new CAFO taking shape there in Crawford County?
For just over a decade now, Roth Feeder Pig 1, their current operation, has been the only operating CAFO, so that's a factory farm of over what they say 1,000 animal units, one animal unit being 1,000-pound steer. And so they've been the largest operation in the county for quite some time. And this new proposal to build an additional and expanded facility that will create about three times as much manure, 9.4 million gallons at the new facility, on a very narrow karstic, so fractured carbonate ridge with sinkholes and caves, right above the lower Kickapoo River, brings up a lot of concerns for groundwater quantity and quality, and general concerns over the Department of Natural Resources regulations being one size fits all and not exactly sufficient for areas like the karstic driftless area where we have such extreme slopes and such susceptible groundwater to pollution.
Is your concern regarding the water pollution issue, is your concern more general that with such a big operation, there is just greater possibility that something could go wrong? Or do you have like a specific reason to think that something will go wrong?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think in general, any amount of manure has to be managed very carefully on this sort of a landscape. When we're talking about this volume of manure, especially liquid manure that's going to have to be applied to the landscape in two short windows in the spring and the fall, when they have the opportunity, that presents even greater challenges. And of course, we can't say that it's guaranteed to pollute the groundwater, but the risk is fairly extreme. And as I mentioned, that ridge there is on top of two layers of carbonate bedrock and is riddled with sinkholes and caves, and there's all sorts of springs around there. And all of these are indications of how many of these karstic direct conduits there are to groundwater. So there's a significant risk there if things are not managed with extreme care. And we had hoped that the Department of Natural Resources would add a number of conditions to the permit that would help ensure that more care was taken, or if things were not being done well, that we would actually have some sort of an idea when issues were occurring from something like a monitoring well.
So I talked to A.V. Roth earlier, and he outlined several different steps that he has been required to take. He says that he has ample storage for the amount of waste in question, and that he said during the windows of time where he has to distribute that across a certain amount of land. He said not only on his land, but he said that he has ample number of nearby farmers who would be more than happy to take that off of his hands. Do you see a problem in his? Obviously, you still object to the thing, so you must see some amount of a problem with his logic there.
Yeah, so in part, there's not all that much land per animal unit available. So when we're talking like a half to a quarter of an animal unit, or a half to a quarter of an acre per animal unit, it leads to a large amount of manure needing to be spread on the fields, and the distinction between really using that manure as the valuable nutrient that it is for maximal agronomic value of the crops, which for corn, for instance, does not benefit from phosphorus over 35 parts per million in the soil. However, at the current operation of growth feeder pig, where we've been monitoring their operations and doing subsidizing well testing and doing water quality monitoring in local streams and looking at the nutrient management plan and the actual soil values of phosphorus, and we see fields over 100, over 200, over 300, over 350 parts per million phosphorus. And, you know, in theory, there are rules and regulations, and those rules and regulations say that the fields, once they're over 200 parts per million in phosphorus, there is to be no more spreading there unless it's an absolute emergency and you get special permission to do so. Between 100 and 200, you're supposed to be spreading at levels that will slowly decrease the phosphorus to more optimal levels over time. Why are we seeing fields that are over 300 parts per million? Apparently, the nutrient monitoring or the nutrient management plans and the best practices that we're all assured are being operated under on paper, there's some sort of difference between that and what's actually happening on the land. And the DNR is permitting these two operations separately, so they're not considering really the past history of the current operation in the permitting of this new operation, which I believe is also a mistake. And we essentially consider them one operation. It's the same owners. The facilities are only a few miles apart, are going to be largely spreading over the same landscape, same sub watersheds. And in combination, these two facilities of growth feeder pigs would make them the largest hog CAFO in the state, in an area that we could make a pretty strong argument is one of the most susceptible and sensitive areas in the state.
Is that water testing, or is that soil testing that you've already done?
Yeah, so the soil test I was referring to, growth feeder pig actually does those. They're required to take soil samples, but that is public information through their nutrient management plan. The streams, we work through the DNR and UW Extension Water Action Volunteers Program and bring volunteers and do monitoring in streams of specific concern, and have been finding generally bad results and generally worsening results over the last decade and more that we've been monitoring in streams.
And you believe that that is directly attributable to the growth pig operation?
Well, these are watershed scale issues. So we can never say this stream is polluted only because of this operation. But when we think about the volumes of manure being applied to the landscape, 9.5 million gallons is a much greater risk to the groundwater and the surrounding surface watersheds than a fraction of that. And I think it's an important distinction to make between the liquid manure stored and spread from these lagoons, which is 95 to 99% water, and solid manure being deposited directly on the landscape through some sort of a grazing or pasture-based operation. And the difference in the decomposition of those and the amount of nutrients for that you get for the amount of water that goes onto the landscape. And when we're talking 95 to 99% water, a lot of that is going to get pushed down into the groundwater and off into the surrounding landscape, especially when we're talking about fields that we're seeing well above 200 parts per million in phosphorus, where if you're seeing that level of phosphorus, that means there's almost certainly a good amount of nitrogen that's being pushed down into the groundwater and running off into the surrounding watersheds.
In addition to the water quality issues and the potential for contamination there, some reporting that I've read raised the issue of just the basically the smell. Is that like a pollution issue, or is that more of a quality of life issue that you would be concerned about?
Again, I think it's both pollution in terms of the health concern and quality of life as far as neighbors being able to really enjoy their property outside. And that, unfortunately, is not something the DNR really covers in CAFO permits. This operation was not required, this new facility was not required to do any testing or reporting on emissions to the air quality at all. And again, in this specific location where this is being proposed, I don't know if you've ever driven along the Kickapoo River on a foggy morning, but the denser air and the fog really pools in that valley. And if the air currents are going in the wrong direction, or if there's a downdraft at all, the fumes coming from this facility could really pool in that valley down below. And there's a little residential area along the Kickapoo River right below this proposed facility, and it raises pretty serious concerns. And that's one of the biggest concerns that we hear from neighbors in the immediate facility area, but it's not something that the DNR really covers. And they did a very limited air quality test around the first operation, where they tested for a couple days at two points in the summer when it was not spreading season, either the spring or the fall, when the smell is going to be much more intense. And they determined from that very limited study that it wasn't a concern, and basically used that to say that this facility, this new facility, even though it's three times larger, would also not be a concern.
Now, if people are listening to our conversation, I mean, my conversation with you and I feel like my conversation with Mr. Roth are both relatively short, and there's a lot of detail here that we're just not able to get into. If people are interested in learning more about your perspective on this issue, where can they find that information from the Crawford Stewardship Project?
Yeah, so we have a website, crawfordstewardship.org, and we're also on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the social media. On our website, there's a place you can go where you can sign up for our emailings. We send out newsletters. We've been talking with the news a fair amount in the recent times. And we have a community calendar that people can sign up for. We're really dedicated to trying to share the good work in conservation and stewardship being done in this area among all groups, not just what we do. And there's a lot of great work being done to promote rotational grazing and regenerative agriculture and farmers markets and all these positive solutions too, because it's not just about being afraid of one style of producing food, but if we're not going to go in that direction, if we're not going to have CAFOs, then we need to have the alternative. And we're very fortunate in this area to have an abundance of alternatives and an abundance of local family farms producing food that is being sold in our local communities, and not just being shipped off to these giant slaughterhouses and 30% of it being exported to China and the rest of the world.
Forrest Yonke is with the Crawford Stewardship Project. Forrest, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Well, thanks much for having me. Appreciate you following the topic.
Certainly. And remember, you can hear this conversation again or stream any of our previous episodes on demand. Just go to WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Or find Newsmakers in your favorite podcast app. Coming up, election season is just around the corner, and there's a big race heating up in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. We're talking about it next. That's coming up on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin studios. Wisconsin's embattled redistricting process is finally complete, leaving candidates and voters to re-examine who lives where and who votes for whom. That includes candidates and voters in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which comprises most of our listening area, a seat held by Democratic Representative Ron Kind for some 25 years. Ron Kind is not seeking re-election. Joining us to talk about the redistricting process and how it shakes out for our Newsmakers audience here in the 3rd District is Peter Cameron. Peter is the managing editor of the nonpartisan nonprofit news service, The Badger Project, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to Newsmakers. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Redistricting, some of us more familiar with it than others, but what we hear throughout all the conversations about it is how it gets so contentious. A lot of people remember what happened 10 years ago, and a lot of people have been following what's happening in the courts now, or at least what is concluding in the courts now. So why is redistricting such an important and, because of that, contentious issue?
Well, it's because decides who votes for who. So redistricting is a factor in congressional races for the U.S. House of Representatives and for the state legislature. And in 2010, 2011, the Republicans had full control of state government, so were able to draw the maps themselves. And you saw the result of that, which was in a really 50-50 politically split state. Republicans held the state legislature basically the entire time and almost had supermajorities, two-thirds supermajorities. This time around, it was slightly different. It was because the governor is a Democrat. The Republicans, one political party wasn't able to just draw the lines. Tony Evers, the Democratic governor, vetoed them, the maps that the legislature drew up, and so they went to the courts. GIS, with computer programs now, politicians from both parties can draw hyper-specific maps to really get the results they want. You can dig down into the data. You can look and see voting trends and voting patterns of municipalities, and you can throw out, you throw Democratic votes into a Democratic district, and you leave things where you want so that you really can get the results that you want, and the proof is in the pudding. You saw how gerrymandering worked for Republicans in Wisconsin in the last 10 years, and Democrats do it in other states, and it's just highly efficient now with the computer programs that they have.
People might wonder, like, just how specific it can get, and we're talking about the 3rd District in this conversation, but I remember going on 2 years ago when I was preparing for a series of interviews with candidates for state assembly and state senate. I was looking at those districts, and there was one where it was a largely contiguous district, some sort of oblong-looking square-ish shape, but it had this little like fish hook that came out on the end of it just to circle in one little neighborhood, and it was obvious that somebody had drawn that like tiny little sliver into that district for probably just to include the population of that neighborhood in the district. But that happens all over. Is anybody talking seriously about any way to prevent that kind of activity from happening?
Well, I mean, you could take redistricting out of the hands of politicians, and that's in some states they've done that. In Michigan, for example, they got a ballot. They got a ballot initiative on the ballot in 2020. Citizens basically took that power away from politicians. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, we can't do ballot initiatives. So in Michigan, they gotta, you know, they have to get a certain amount of signatures, kind of like a recall election here. You get together a certain amount of signatures, you can get the question on the ballot, do you want to have a nonpartisan redistricting commission? And they did in Michigan. And so now the lines are basically, it's a fair fight in Michigan, whereas they were heavily gerrymandered in the last decade. But for us to have fair maps, to have non-politically drawn maps, it's going to have to come either from the state Supreme Court, and I'll talk about that in a minute, or from Congress. And Democrats do want to, at the national level in Congress, eliminate partisan gerrymandering, partisan redistricting. But, you know, there's so much going on right now, and it couldn't break a filibuster in the Senate right now. So, I mean, Democrats would need much larger majorities in the Senate than they have now at the national level. At the state level, there's an election coming up for the state Supreme Court for one of the conservative justices on the state Supreme Court. And those seats are supposed to be nonpartisan, but everybody knows they're not. And so this right-leaning justice is running next, has to run again next year. And if left-leaning folks flip that seat, then that'll change the majority on the state Supreme Court from a 4-3 conservative majority to a 4-3 left-leaning liberal majority. And, you know, if somebody could bring a court case, and that could change everything. So that'll be a big election in 2023.
It's interesting. And since you mentioned the Supreme Court, the maps that were drawn this year have been through the court up to the Supreme Court. And in the piece that you wrote, that is the impetus for this conversation about the third district for the Badger Project, you wrote about it, this year's maps being somewhat of a split victory for Wisconsin Democrats and Wisconsin Republicans.
Yeah, so in past years when state government has been split, like it was this year, where the Republicans had one party had the legislature, one party had the governor's seat, it's usually the map drawing has gone to federal courts. That happened the three times before 2010, so what, 1980, 1990, and 2000. This time, the state Supreme Court decided to make the decision themselves. They said, we'll make the decision. So that was a big thing that the state Supreme Court decided to do. Another big decision they made was that they went with a conservative argument that the map should be based on least changes from the old maps, from the most recent maps. The argument being that, well, the maps from 2000 in the past decade were drawn by democratically elected politicians rather than an appointed federal court, which sounds good, but of course, those democratically elected politicians then drew maps that heavily favored their political party. And that decision, a UW law professor told me that decision to have maps drawn that were changed minimally from the old maps was, that's a very unusual decision. Usually courts have made that restriction before, but usually it's on maps that are without much partisan lean. It's you know, the courts in the past nationally have said, yeah, don't make many changes, but it's usually when the basis maps are, you know, kind of a nonpartisan or evenly drawn maps. This time, of course, that wasn't the case. Our maps are heavily partisanly skewed, and so the court said you have to base them off of that. Democrats submitted maps, Republicans submitted maps, obviously both parties trying to tweak the maps as much as they can to maximize their advantage. And initially the state Supreme Court accepted the maps submitted by Democrats, which, you know, moved the needle a little bit more in their favor. And then after that decision was made, the case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the state legislature, or they didn't throw them out. They said there needed to be more justification for the state legislative maps, which kicked it back down to the state Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to take any action on the congressional maps that the Democrats submitted. So that was the Democrats' kind of minor victory There was a little minor victory in the third, in your third district. Right now, Portage County, which includes Stevens Point, sort of the liberal college town of Stevens Point, is included in the third district. It's really a gerrymander. It's been in the northern seventh district for a long time. Republicans moved it into the third district because at the time when they did this back in 2011, Dave Obie had held that northern seventh district for like 40 years. And Republicans were trying to make the seventh up north more holdable, more winnable for themselves. And so they threw the blue Stevens Point, Portage County into the third district.
And that at that time, like some 10 years ago, they were basically conceding that the third district was a pretty strongly held Democratic district, right?
Right, which, I mean, I guess it was. But Republicans Democrats have collapsed in rural areas. So now that northern seventh district, Democrats at right now have no chance. It's just a heavily Republican district. And the third is now, you know, a swing district. Trump actually won it last in 2020 or in 2020. And so now Republicans, when they submitted their congressional maps, they tried to move Portage County and Stevens Point back into the seventh to make the third more red, you know, more winnable for Republicans. And but that sort of went against the lease change mandate from the state Supreme Court. So state Supreme Court did not accept their maps. And, you know, now I called it a blunder, a gerrymandering blunder. I mean, based on what we know now. And so that keeps the third a little bit more, not left leaning, but it makes it more competitive for Democrats.
And in your piece that you wrote for the Badger Project on that, you talked about how the changes in this year's map versus the one that was in play a couple of years ago in the third district are relatively minor. Talk about what those changes are. It really encompasses a small portion sort of in the far northern part of the district being cut out of that district and another equally small portion on the eastern border of the district being folded into the district. Have I got that right, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, they're very minor changes. Probably insignificant. So Cadott up in, I'm just looking at the map here as we talk, Cadott near Eau Claire, near Chippewa Falls, up in northern Wisconsin, and a couple small sort of rural municipalities up there were moved out. And in the southern part of the state, we've got Ithaca, Lone Rock, Woodland, LaVale. Is that how you say it? LaVale? Ironton, Lime Ridge. These are towns that I was not even familiar with, and maybe some of your listeners are, but those were moved into the district. But yeah, really, really minor changes. I'd be curious to, I don't know why these changes were made. These were Democratic changes that they made. So why they made them, I don't know, but it looks insignificant to me.
This, of course, is all leading up to the August primaries and November general election in the third district and in all the other congressional districts as well. As I said, Representative Ron Kind, the Democrat who has held that seat for 25 years, is not running for re-election. And I'm wondering how the race to replace him is shaping up. I know on the Republican side, Derek Van Orden, who ran against him last time, never really stopped running. So I'm wondering if any other Republicans are sort of making waves on that side of the battle. And then on the Democratic side of the battle, I'm wondering if there are any names rising to the top as actual contenders to run against someone who now is quite a well-known Republican in this area.
I'll say that I keep making predictions on elections and I get them wrong every time. So
me too.
I think a lot of us do that. But Van Norden is probably the favorite. He's pretty, I see him on social media all the time. He's pretty relentless. He seems to be out and about. The third district is huge. It stretches all the way from the bottom southwestern corner of Wisconsin, Platteville, all the way up to Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and then into Stevens Point, like we said. So it's just a massive, I don't know, that must be 200 miles long, something like that. So, you know, you have to have the energy to get around the district. He seems to. He's got a couple of problems in that he was at the January 6th protest riot at the Capitol. He said he was, you know, he didn't go into the Capitol, but he was at Trump's speech, and he had said he didn't go into a certain part of the Capitol. And there was some reporting that in fact he did. I think he'd taken a photo of himself in an area where it passed a security line or something, where he said he hadn't gone there. He was also recently fined for, he had a loaded gun in his bag, but he was trying to fly out of an airport in Iowa, I think. So are these going to be problems for him? We'll see. But yeah, I think the smart money is on him to win this year, and what people are considering to be a Republican year, 2022 being a Republican year. On the Democratic side, there's Brad Pfaff, the state senator who won a very tight state Senate election, a really expensive state Senate election last time. That they're probably the favorites. If what you think is going to happen, if Van Orden wins, maybe you get a rematch in 2024. It's going to be it's a swing district, and that's good. I mean, they should all be swing districts. So, and I mean, one thing I'm confident in predicting is going to be a very expensive election. There's going to be tons of spending. You're just going to get, are going to get hammered with political advertising. So just brace for that.
It's going to be an interesting race to watch. And I know I know that Wisconsin Public Radio will be involved in covering it. All of our local media colleagues will as well. But I'm interested in reading more about what the Badger Project is doing. You were telling me that you've got an upcoming look at expenditures related to this election and a number of other ways that you're working to cover politics here in Wisconsin. Tell me about the Badger Project and where people can find your work.
Sure. So we're online. Our website is www.thebadgerproject.org. I'm a former newspaper reporter. I started this working in newspapers. Our staff continued to shrink, and we just didn't have time to do long form investigative stuff. And so my goal with this organization is to do that work, and then we give it to newspapers. So we run in the La Crosse Tribune frequently. We run in the Chippewa Herald. We run in news organizations across the state. That's we're trying to fill that gap of newspaper staff shrinking and not able to do what they used to do. One thing we'll do in this election year is we'll do background checks of candidates, as many as we can, looking at various things in candidates' past and claims they make. We also do closer to the fall and the election time. We'll look at campaign finances. We'll look at who is donating directly to candidates, who is spending independently of candidates, because now a super PAC can come in and spend money and say this candidate's bad or this candidate's good, and working independently of the campaign. So that's always important information to know. One important thing about that I should tell everyone, one important thing about campaign finance law in Wisconsin is that while there are limits on what you can donate directly to candidates, depends on what office they're running for, there is currently no limit on what a person can donate to a political party in Wisconsin. So what that means is that J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, the Democratic governor of Illinois, can cut a check for $2 million to the Wisconsin Democrats, which he did in 2020. Diane Hendricks, another wealthy political donor, she's in the Janesville-Beloit area. She has ABC Building Supplies, her company. She donates millions, and they can if you write a check to a candidate, again, it's limited by state law and campaign finance law, but there's currently no limit on what you can donate to the political parties, and then they can turn around and spread that money around. So it's kind of a loophole in campaign finance law right now that wasn't always there. It's a long story why it's open now. Democrats are trying to close it. Maybe Republicans might want to close it because they were the ones that loosened campaign finance law in the last 10 years, and that favored them initially, but now Democrats and left-leaning donors are really spending a lot and donating a lot. So it's maybe a wash. Maybe Democrats are actually they're benefiting from these changes, but we'll see. I feel pretty strongly that this is going to be every year is more expensive than the last. So you're just be seeing more and more ads and mailers in your mailbox and stuff on social media. So get ready for it.
Peter Cameron is managing editor of the Badger Project. Peter, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Check out the great work of the redistricting from Peter at thebadgerproject.org. That's thebadgerproject.org. And for more from WPR, check out WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. It's all online at wpr.org/mappedout or search for Mapped Out in your favorite podcatcher. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you can listen to our program every week. We're on Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3, Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9, and of course, we're always online at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our producer is Dawn Jewell. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here from Wisconsin Public Radio.